Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 27th, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Norm Day. Today's session number is DAN 2001-01 and is titled History of the Holden Mine. Let's listen in to Norm.
Day, I'm with the Forest Service. I'm the project manager for the cleanup project, and I sort of put this presentation together just for this week. It's in addition to some of the other ones I'll be showing later this week on the mine cleanup project. Putting this together, I used several sources, and it's probably, might as well get officially started now, but I used several publications. One of them is Nigel Adams' book on the history of the Holden Mine, and it's available in the bookstore, at least it was last year. And I would show it to you, but I'm using it to keep the And the other one is, I'm using a lot of pictures out of this book by Larry Pennington, who worked in the mine as a metallurgist the first few years and took a bunch of photographs in the first 2 years of the mine production. Also, I use information put together by Dr. Rudy Edmond on the mine history and that, plus all the files and records of the House Sound Mining Company, which we have in our office. Not all, but a good number of them in Wenatchee as part of our administrative record. So it's kind of an interesting history, and I've been able to find a number of old historical pictures that I've kind of digitized and put into this presentation. So I hope it turns out pretty good. I sure appreciate any feedback you have on it. Your feet are in the way. The Holden Mine story actually begins before Holden ever entered the Cascades, but back in the 1850s, discoveries of precious metals, particularly gold, were made in the Wenatchee area, up in the Fort Colville area, and around Yakima and in between. And that's what brought the miners into this area. And soon after that, there were small workings and diggings and prospect pits from Yakima all the way to the Canadian border. Again, mostly looking for precious metals, gold, free gold, placer gold. And while people probably had seen some base metal or copper deposits in the mountains while they were here, because of the rugged terrain, the remoteness, underground mining of copper and zinc just wasn't profitable. But that placer gold sure brought them into the area. Probably the most notable comparable operation to the Holden mine was the Monte Cristo mine. And it was actually located on the other side of the, here's Holden mine, and it was actually located on the other side of the Cascades in Snoqualmie County near Silverton. And that mine operated from 1892 to 1909 and produced $7 million in gold and silver. And it was developed by the J.D. Rockefeller Syndicate. And that in addition to the gold mining in the Wenatchee area, brought additional miners. And this time it brought the miners up into the headwaters of the Skagit River and into the north end of Lake Chelan looking for minerals. Well, you got big feet. Well, that's probably going to be worse.
What's the matter?
I don't understand.
There you go. That's better. Anyway, in addition to the prospectors and miners that were coming into the area for precious metals, the Great Northern Railroad was trying to find a way to expand their railroad from Wenatchee up to Okanagan. And in the effort to do that, they were looking for mineral and timber resources in this area, and particularly in the Lake Chelan area. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with the railroad land grants that were given for the expansion of the railroads in the West, but railroad companies to have an incentive to put in their railroad would be giving, and I don't remember exactly how far he decided the railroad line, but they'd be given every other section of land for, I think, up to 6 miles on either side of the rail line as an incentive. And so it'd be, they'd become railroad property, and they could do with that as they wish.
Like a right-of-way or something?
Well, it was along the right-of-way, but it was actually, this was all federal land at this time. We were, and the land grants were given to the railroad company for development of the West. I mean, that's really what sparked the railroads through the West. It was very expensive, and if it hadn't been for these incentives, it would not have happened for many years. So anyway, they would get quite a bit of land along the right-of-way, and that's what they were doing. They were looking for resources in the Lake Chelan area to see if there were enough timber and mineral resources that they could capitalize on if they built the railroad. So they were in this area and in Lake Chelan, northern end of Lake Chelan, probably even into Railroad Creek, looking in between 1888 and 1893.
Were there Native Americans in the area?
Yes. And I'm sure then there, I don't know a lot about the history, but I'm sure there were many conflicts. And there's the Caldwell Indian they have a large reservation not too far from here up by Omak. It's currently on fire. The big, large Virginia Lakes complex is mostly on Caldwell reservation land. There's, I think they've already burned 90,000 acres over there. But anyway, yes, they were in the area at the time and probably used, and we even have some petroglyphs along Lake Chelan, so I know they used the lake also. And by 1891, the miners in this area had actually even established the Lake Chelan Mining District. Yeah, kind of drop back a little bit, but this is when Holden, J.H. Holden, kind of comes into the picture. He was born in 1855 in New York and moved west at the age of 19 to strike it rich in the gold fields of Nevada and Colorado. Unfortunately, he didn't strike it rich, so after a while, he left those areas and went to Seattle. And the picture on the left is a picture of Holden in his 20s, and on the right in his 50s. In 1888, Holden was in Seattle and he met Victor Denny. And the Dennys are important family in the Seattle area. They're a financial family, had financial interest in the Seattle area. And Holden would work for the Denny, particularly Victor Denny, off and on doing odds and ends as a caretaker, camp tender, and even a prospector for them in the Lake Chelan area. Even before the turn of the century, Lake Chelan was a very popular recreation spot for people to come from Seattle and other areas. And so the Denny family would often come to the Lake Chelan area for holiday, and Holden would help tend their camp, and he was also an off and on doing a certain amount of prospecting and a lot in the Railroad Creek area. He would come to Lake Chelan early in the spring and kind of follow the snow line up Railroad Creek and some of the other drainages in the area prospecting.
What? Can you go back?
I think I can. Oh, well, let's see here.
Quick Street.
Oh, it's just
previous.
Yeah, previous.
Oh, he would provide funding. He would give him money or supplies, or money to buy supplies, food, and other equipment to prospect. And that might be a good one word for you to look up sometime. I'm sure that's kind of interesting if you looked into the roots of it. Anyway, as the story goes, on July 24th, 1896, Holden discovered the ore body here while out grouse hunting. He was out in the area prospecting and allegedly hunting grouse for lunch when he saw this mineralized bedrock. And it was this, you can see places around here, this reddish colored or orangish colored rock, which is an iron stained rock that the exploration or geologists call it a gossan, but it's the weathered part of an ore body. And it's where the sulfide minerals like pyrite and chalcopyrite have a lot of sulfur and iron in them, and they, when they oxidize, they produce essentially rust, or they rust. So in ore zones, at the upper end of the ore zones, a lot of times you can find evidence of them on the surface in these gossans. And so that's what Holden found. This is the discovery point right here, and it's 4,900 feet up on the hill, and if we were outside, you could kind of follow the ridge up a couple different benches, and you get up just about a timberline, and that's where this outcrop is here. And I don't know that this is where he saw it. I think he probably saw it down lower and traced it all the way up to this point, because any of you have been up to Honeymoon Heights yet, and if you go up all the way to the 550 level, you cross the snow avalanche a couple times, and the upper crossing, you're right in bedrock. And if you look around there, you can see this iron-colored rock. If you had your rock pick with you, you could probably even knock off some of that weather stuff and find some sulfide minerals right on the surface. He originally located four mining claims, and one of them he gave to his packer, Mr. Robinson. He was one that was helping him pack into the area. Holden's conduct after the discovery was somewhat less than exemplary. He never gave any recognition to the Victor to the Denny family, which provided a lot of funding for his grub staking.
But he was on his lunch break when
he found. Yeah.
So he's covered in his contract, right?
The time clock was off. Yeah. But anyway, you know, there's a lot of stories. Pro and con about Holden, but I think Holden kind of danced the line between a respectful person and a real scoundrel.
Don't say that.
Down at Lucerne, there's a informational sign that indicates the forest was burned.
Yes, and I'll get to that.
Oh,
you'll see some pictures I took when I was there.
You were there when we burned.
Sure. Anyway, after Holden located his four claims in 1896, he spent the next 2 years trying everything he could to get a buyer for him, because he's not a miner. He didn't know how to mine, but he knew how to promote, and so that's what he was trying to do, was to sell his property and find someone that would buy him. He did do prospecting and some limited development work within those first 2 years. But this is a picture taken at the turn of the century from Hart Lake. That's the waterfall, or not much of a waterfall, up at Hart Lake. At least that's what it appears to me, looking down Railroad Creek in the early 1900s. Anyway, meanwhile, while Holden was working his claims, he was also trying to establish himself in the Chelan community. And on 1898, he married, and married a 23-year-old daughter of a local rancher. And at that time, Holden was 43. This allegedly is his home. I doubt that it was their home when they first got married, because he did obtain quite a bit of wealth later on in his years. But it's the only picture I could find, anyway.
Where was it located?
In Chelan. And I don't know the exact address or anything, but actually, if there may be more information about that in Nigel's book. Holden and Alma had four sons, their first being born just shortly after, about a year after they got married. Oftentimes in the early years, probably until Alma got further on in her pregnancy, they would actually help Holden do some of the claim development work out of the claim. Anyway, by By 1897, they had driven in two 22-foot tunnels, and on the vein, on the two of the upper mining claims. And while that may not seem like a lot of work, they were all done by hand tools. In other words, they would use these hand steel and sledgehammer, and that would be how they'd drill their holes, and then they would load it with powder. That was one of the claims, AMH and the mini claim. That was one of the other two claims. And there was the Lucille claim and the Robinson claim.
Where did AMH
come? You know, I figured that out once, but right now I don't remember. I mean, if you look at some of the names of the people that were involved in this, it makes sense, but I can't think of it right now.
Is this
Langston?
Is it
Alma? It could be Alma.
What's her last name before she had
Lord.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's what I thought too.
That could be Alma.
Yeah, but he made the claims before they were married, right? He
yeah.
Claims
yeah.
Before he murdered.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, H could have been his mother.
Yeah. Well, most of the development work done after 1896, though, was on the mini claim, and that claim was at an elevation about the second claim down, and about. It was about 200 feet lower elevation than where the discovery point was. And he built a cabin there as well. And a lot of people thought that he had a cabin in Honeyman Heights, and that's not correct. The cabin that he built and lived in while he was doing a lot of this development work was almost 1,000 feet higher on the hillside than where the Honeyman Heights area is.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know that our archaeologists they looked for it, apparently, but never been able to find it. But you got to figure that was back in the turn of the century and would have been pretty well decomposed by now. There were the two tunnels that he started working on were the number one and number two tunnels. And today they would be known as the 550 and 800 levels of the mine. Well, eventually Holden was able to get some geological survey work done of his deposit, and it indicated that the ore zone was 75 to 100 feet in width and up to 3,000 feet in length. And at that point in time, he wasn't able to find either the north or south, or the I guess it'd be east or west ends of it, the end lines, nor did he know how deep it went. But based on the drilling and the work they did in the first few years, he was able to indicate that he had a fairly sizable ore body that averaged 5 to 10% copper and about $3 per ton gold and 5 to 11 ounces of silver per ton from assays that he took of the rock they were working on. In the fall of 1899, he founded the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company with him as president, and he discovered this was a way he could make money. By selling stock in this company, he could make money for himself, but also provide funding to continue the costly endeavor of exploring that deposit and finding someone to purchase it from him. By 1900, it extended the two principal tunnels and connected them by a shaft or winze. And this is a picture from that work. This is the winze is probably off this direction. It's like a shaft, but it's inside the mine. So it'd be vertical or near vertical as opposed to the horizontal openings, which are called drifts or crosscuts in a mine. This would be down. And you can see right here, they're working right over this winze, and they've got the bucket, and they would lower that bucket, and someone would be down there filling it with muck, and then they would drill and blast and fill the bucket with ore or muck and bring it up and load it in their mine car right here and haul out and dump it on the surface. And you can see the waste dumps from that early effort way up high on the hillside. In late 1900, Holden was able to get the Drummers Development Company interested in entering into a contract with him to bring this mine into production within 2 years. That was the agreement in this contract. And Holden would get a 10% royalty of everything that was produced. And they also formed another company, a subsidiary company, called the Chelan Transportation and Smelting Company, that was going to be responsible for transporting the ore down lake to Chelan, where they would have a smelter, a mill and a smelter. And this is pretty grandiose plans, but it's kind of interesting to see in this old illustration that I came across, and this was contracted out in an effort to put together a proposal that they could then sell to some other mining company. But anyway, they're on the prospectus. But this is the number two and number three tunnels that I had mentioned to you before, and their idea was to bring all the ore out of the number three tunnel and haul it down by a tram to the Railroad Creek here, load it on railroad cars, and then haul it all the way down to Lake Chelan, where it'd be loaded on barges and barged down to Chelan, where it would then be milled and smelted. Of course, this is, you know, all the ore in the mine we have here came out of the 1500 level. This level right here is really the 1100 level, which is one of the higher waste dumps on the hillside. It's not where the ore currently comes out. So this was her proposal. You notice also, and I'll get to this later, these trees look burned. Now, there was a reason for that. They had been, but here's a picture, another one of the illustrations showing how they were going to get the ore from the mine down to Lake Chelan. This is down at Lucerne. Right here's Railroad Creek flowing into Lake Chelan. And here's the railroad line that they... And you see these big sweeping curves. And right here, this is where the bus goes up to switchbacks right here. It would have then come across Railroad Creek in that big canyon that you kind of look at as you're going up the bus. And then it would have come down here, and you can see it makes a big circle where the train would have come over here into Refrigerator Harbor, which is where the Forest Service has a campground, would have offloaded its ore onto the barges and then come back around and gone back up.
It's a long trip.
Anyway, the peak employment for this project was in 1901, and they did quite a bit of underground mining and conducted in four of the tunnels, again, all by hand mining methods. And they actually even had a headquarters located at, kind of a headquarters office located down at Lucerne. And their crews actually started work on the railroad and tram in 1901. It was going to have a 4% grade, it was going to be a real narrow track. And by 1903, here they are working on the roadbed. That had to be pretty hard work. But by 1903, they had actually completed the roadbed all the way from Lucerne up to the mine site. They'd cut and hewed 30,000 railroad ties were allegedly spread along this route all the way from Refrigerator Harbor to the mine. They hadn't put in any of the bridges yet this time, but they had, and they hadn't put any of the track, but they completed the railroad grade and had all the ties ready to go. And unfortunately, their board of directors for this Drummond's company finally figured that they had spent way too much money, and it wasn't look like they were getting any profit. They'd already spent almost $100,000, and there was no signs that they were ever going to get any revenue out of this. So eventually they withdrew from their lease agreement with Holden and in 1903, but they had 2 years left apparently on the agreement, so about all they did the last 2 years was to burn brush along the right of way. Hopefully not in a year like this year. In 1905 was the next player in this story, J.P. Graves, from the vice president for Granby Mining Company, became interested in Holden Mine, and he rescued Holden from bankruptcy and was made president of the Holden Mining Company. And between 1905 and 1913, Graves, as president of the Holden Gold and Mining Copper Mining Company, also entered into an agreement with Granby Mining, Granby Consolidated Mines. And over the years that Graves had the property, he was kind of known as the great consolidator of all Holden's interests. He led to a lot of development of the claims. Here's a picture of the mining crew that were out here every year, driving those drifts further into the mountainside, drilling holes to determine the mineral content of the ore zone, and essentially developing the ore body and finding more information out about it, whether they could ever make a mine out of it. Now, this is one of the more interesting pictures I've come across. Harry, this might be one you'd be interested in. This was taken in 1909, during that period of time that Graves and the Granby Mining Company had or held the lease on Holden property. They, besides doing a lot of underground development work, they also had a guy by the name of Lindsay come out and take a lot of pictures, black and white pictures of the area and the mine, I guess for promotional purposes or whatever. But this is a picture taken in 1909 from somewhere on this side of the hill looking back across to the deposit. And this is the number 3 tunnel, and at this time it was 1,400 feet long. This is the number 2 tunnel, and it was approximately 500 feet long. This number 3 tunnel was 1,100 level, and this became the 800 level when they changed the designations for the mine. Right here is this is Honeymoon Heights right here. That little bench, mm-hmm. You can see there's already some structures where they had their camp and things like this. You can see all the trails they used to come from the valley up to the area. These are probably pretty close to the trail you walk down when you go up Honeymoon Heights. But you do notice that the area has been burned. And there was a rumor, at least I'd always heard a rumor, that this area had been burned by one of the, by prospector trying to prospect for more minerals, and I'd never seen any evidence of it. To me, it was just a rumor, but when I came across this picture, it shows that it was burned sometime prior to 1909, probably in the early 1900s, and the allegation is that Robinson, the packer, Holden's packer, who was given one of the claims, had started the fire in an effort to look for more valuable minerals in this area.
I'm a little confused. How would that have helped? Still a lot of ground to cover.
That's true, but if they could burn off the vegetation, you can see the rocks better, what rocks there are. Mm-hmm. And so that was his, it was pretty dense vegetation, I'm sure, when Holden was here. And since the ore body does crop out of the surface,
I'm sort of surprised because it's mostly coniferous around here, and usually there's not much ground stuff under, shrubs, short shrub stuff mm-hmm. underneath that because of the soil.
Well, you'll have to talk to Robinson, but the logic, in some areas he probably would have observed additional, where the rock was actually cropping out on the surface, or boulders that may have had minerals in it. Some of these avalanche chutes, there's pretty thick vegetation, and if you got the vegetation out there, maybe you can see something.
Is it because they're trying to see from a distance where different layers of rock are, or just because they can see it better close up?
Well, I think by this time, Holden had a pretty good idea. He mapped his claims map the bedrock on his claims pretty good by this point in time. But they were looking, Robinson was looking for some other showings that, that weren't evident. At least that's the allegation that he burned the area. Just for your interest, the other some of the other workings, it may be a little hard to see here, but you go on up the hill here. This is what's the, called the 550 level. Now, this is where the Honeymoon Heights Trail ends, if you were to take it all the way up. From here, you got to scramble up the hillside. There is a open cut right in here that you can still see. In other words, it's where they had done some blasting on the surface, but they hadn't sunk a tunnel in. And then the 300 level, which is the highest level, is about 150 feet up from this point here. And then the discovery point's another 300 feet above that. Let's see. Okay.
So no tunnel was dug at
the what?
Either of those two ladder spots.
I'm sorry?
No tunnel was dug at either of those two ladder spots. Nothing.
The 300 or?
Yeah. And the.
Well, there is now. There wasn't at that point in time. And there's no tunnel at the open cut, which is still. But there was at the 500 level. There's actually two. There was a 500. Well, they called it tunnel one and tunnel one and a half. But they're both at the 550 level. If you've ever been up there, there's actually two caved adits at that point. Anyway, at the end of the lease period in 1913, the Granby Company dropped its interest in Holden, and they didn't. And this is largely because of the price of copper had been going down. While they recognized a fairly sizable ore deposit, it was the price of copper that was the problem. So they dropped the property, dropped the lease with Holden, and then it wasn't until 1916 that Granby came back into the picture with another lease option with Holden. The Granby Company reports were very favorable on the Holden deposit, and if it hadn't been for the price of copper, they probably would have continued development work at that time. This is another one of Lindsay's pictures right here of their old steam-powered engine they used, a compressor for compressed air. By this time, they probably had some of the air percussion drills now that were able to drill. They actually had driven by this time about 3,000 feet of diamond hole drill. I don't know if you know what that is, but if you've been up to the museum, you'll see cylinders of rock about so wide, and this is where they will drill into the rock and recover a segment of the rock, and they can then analyze that. They can identify the rock types, identify the minerals, and then actually do assays on it. All good things come to an end, but after two cancer operations, Holden died on May 19th, 1918, from complications of cancer. Now, he died in Soap Lake, and he'd gone there because of the mineral aspects of the water at Soap Lake, hoping that would somehow cure his cancer, but it didn't. And he was 63 at the time. And some of the legacies, he was a very shrewd promoter and developer of his property, despite some of the more unexemplary stories about Holden, but he did do a lot to develop the Lake Chelan area. His constant interest in trying to develop the Holden mine brought a lot of interest, mining interest, into this area. Some of you may have heard, but during the up until the First World War, there was actually a molybdenum mine further up Railroad Creek, up the Crown Point Falls. And it was at the time a profitable mine. And so Holden did do a lot for this area. But when he died, he was in debt. And despite that, he had earned a comfortable living for his family. You saw his home. At the time he died, the Holden estate owned 13 city blocks within Chelan and other miscellaneous property, but he was still in debt because of the mine. He was always in debt, it seemed like, related to the mine. The one thing that people seemed to think that Holden wanted more than anything else was respect and social status. And he did gain that by the time he died. Unfortunately, he died 20 years before the mine would ever be put into production, so he never really saw his mine become a real mine. The next story is when Crooker Perry took the mine, and he took it through its final stages of development up until the time the Howell Sound Mining Company purchased it. And Crooker Perry capitalized on some loans he made to Holden in about 1915. He made it several years, he made some loans to Holden several years before Holden died. And of course, Holden died without a will. So Mr. Perry, in an effort to get recover his loans, had to initiate a legal action in an emergence lien against the Holden estate. And that went on. There was quite a lengthy legal battle between the Holdens and Mr. Perry, but in the end, Perry won. And in 1925, he reorganized the Holden Mining Company into the Lake Chelan Copper Company. And again, for a brief period of time, the Granby Company came back into the picture, renewed its interest into the Holden Mine. One of their chief engineers left Granby to work for a company called Britannia Metals and Smelting Company. And later on, Britannia Company became Howell Sound Mining Company. And in the late 1920s, about 1928 or so, the Howell Sound Mining Company, or Britannia, started really getting a lot of interest into the Holden Mine. And by 1930, Howell Sound had agreed to actually purchase all the assets of the Lake Chelan Copper Company, which was once the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company, for $242,000. Mm-hmm. Of course, there were a number of economic changes that led to Howell Sound's interest in purchase of the mine. One of them was that truck transportation became more efficient than rail, and it looked like that it would be cheaper for them to use transport the ore or the concentrate down from the mine to Lake Chelan by truck as opposed to railroad, and the great expense of finishing the railroad bed and maintaining the rail line, and the price of copper had started coming up again. So Howell Sound's first development work lasted from 1928 to 1931, and during that period of time, they put a lot of money into drilling the ore body out, putting a lot more underground workings into the mine to further develop the ore body. They formed a corporation called Shellcop. At this point in time, under which they did all this development work. You know, besides the underground development work, they put in a lot of structures for crews quarters. They winterized a lot of the buildings so they could keep crews up here over the winter, working in the mine. But in 1931, the price of copper fell. But before I get to that, I guess I needed to finish up. Also, by the in the summer of 1930, they had done enough development work and drilling to have identified three ore bodies inside the mountain here, three distinct ore bodies. And at that time, they felt the most efficient way to mine that was not like you'd seen in that one diagram where they bring the ore out at the upper levels, but to sink or to drive a drift in at the 1500 level, kind of underneath the ore bodies, and use gravity to get the ore down to the 1500 level, all out on the 1500 level. So at this point in time, all their work really had been from the 1500 level up. They also, this is actually that 1500 level in the early days when they started driving it in. They had to drive it through about 90 feet of glacial till before they got into the bedrock. And they had to solve some problems as to where were they going to put the mill, where were they going to mill the rock, the ore, where were they going to put the tailings, how were they going to, what kind of method of transportation were they going to use? Were they really going to use trucks, or were they going to use a rail road system or something other than that? And how were they going to get power? And they were looking at putting a hydro plant in down at Domke Lake, or not, I mean not Domke Lake, but down at Lucerne, right near where that gauging station is, I think somewhere in that neck of the woods. Earlier, when Drummond's Development Company had held the property, they even thought about putting a hydropower plant in up at Hart Lake, there in the waterfall. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, so that was one option, was to put a hydro plant down there at Lucerne. Another option was to bring a power line in all the way from Chelan. The options they were looking at for the mill was to mill the ore right at the mine, and then they would have to dispose of all the tailings here. Or they would put the mill down at Chelan or at Lucerne, one of those two locations. And then all the tailings would be piped into the bottom of Lake Chelan, which is the way Britannia, they had a mine up in British Columbia, and that's what they did with their tailings. Actually, there they put it into the submarine environment. So those were some of the options that the company was trying to work through and figure out which was most efficient. And in the end, and it's kind of an interesting story too, but they ended up putting the tailings right here, the mill here, and the tailings right here. There was quite a bit of environmental work that the company did to satisfy the Washington State Game Department and other agencies that were much more active, proactive in looking at mines, at this, particularly in this location, than you would see other places. So there was quite a bit of environmental consideration put into where the tailings were placed and so on. It may not seem like it now, but for that time period, this is probably one of the more environmentally sensitive mines you would find anywhere in the western United States. And it's because of the great interest that people had in Lake Chelan. I mean, there was a lot of public sentiment, as there is today, in Lake Chelan. Again, many additional structures were built during this period, building up a pretty substantial camp up at Honeyman Heights. One of the biggest hazards that faced the mine was safety problems, worker safety, and the fact that this is such a remote location. If someone were injured, seriously injured, it would be quite a while before they could get medical attention.
Is there any, I know for coal mining, there's, black
on
or something, from mining coal?
Well,
you could get silicosis
here, because you had a lot of silica in the rocks, and I haven't personally seen any records to indicate that that was a problem that some of the miners suffered from, but somebody was telling me, I did the mine walk tour last week, and someone told me that they had heard that some of the miners did have respiratory problems from, and it probably wouldn't be black lung in this case.
No,
I
was asking, is there an equivalent sort of disease that happens
mm-hmm.
with people with miners who have copper or
copper?
Yeah. Where you have a lot of silica in the rocks, like these rocks do, you would have problems. We don't want to miss dinner, do we?
Oh, no.
At least I don't. Anyway, even though Howe Sound was forced to temporarily suspend operations in 31, they didn't stop planning. I mean, they moved their people out of the area, but they kept on planning for the mine. Eventually, they were pretty certain that copper prices would return. In 1936, in the summer of 1936, they did send a 30-man crew out to continue working on the developments, the underground developments out here, including completing the 1500 level. At this point in time, they figured they had enough ore to keep a 1,000 ton per day mill busy for 10 years. And they run their mills 365 days a year, so it'll be a continuous operation for 10 years. And their goal at this point in time, they had a news release in the Chelan Mirror, I believe is the name of the Chelan newspaper, on January 21st, 1937, a big release. It just kind of caught everybody cold that the Howe Sound Company announced they were going to be shipping ore from the Holden Mine within 1 year. And you may not realize it, but at that time, Mount site wasn't here, this mill wasn't here, the completion of the road system wasn't in place, they didn't have the docks and all the barges, and they didn't have a power line. So in January they made this announcement, and the only way they could get a mine going in that time, they had various contracts for every different phase of the project, from the construction of the mill, to the construction of the town site, to finishing the road, to building the docks. And to pull this all off, everybody had to really work in sync. And of course, I don't think you ever do any of that quick these days with all the environmental constraints and other things, but this was their goal, to have ore coming out of that mine in 1 year. They still didn't know how they were going to, where they would get their power from. They had applied for a permit to bring in a power line. They finally decided to bring the power line in because the state hydraulics commission, I think that's right, denied their permit for a hydroelectric plant on Railroad Creek. So they then applied for a permit to bring the power line in. At this point in time, they didn't even have that approved, so they brought up a diesel generator and as they were constructing the camp and constructing the mill, they were using this diesel generator to generate electricity.
You know why they were denied the permit on the Railroad Creek?
I can find out, but I don't know off the top of my head. It may have been a potential impact on fisheries, perhaps. I don't know.
I'm just curious that at that time they care.
Yeah. I could probably dig into the records and find that out, but I don't know off the top of my head. Anyway, here's an early picture of the camp, Holden Village, within the first, about 1938 probably. Doesn't look much different now. Anyway, their first major project was completion of the transportation system, and they widened the roads and put in a few bridges, and they had to put in docks both at Lucerne and at Chelan. They had to build the barges that would be used to transport the concentrate. So they were pretty busy. Now, the next big project was constructing the town itself of Holden. Of course, as you probably already know, this was a company town, and because of the remote location, Howe Sound tried to do everything they could to bring the amenities of life anywhere else to this location. And of course, you're familiar with the facilities we have here. Even though it was a company town, they had the bowling alley, the post office, a commissary, and pool hall. They had quite a nice life for the miners. but in an attempt to prevent absenteeism and to promote more efficient mining, they did not allow the sale of alcohol in the town. Of course, there was a tavern down in CERN, and there were a few that made their own homebrew, both wine and beer, and as I think you can do today, maybe not with alcohol, you could give some money to the bus driver, and the bus driver would take some. Today they wouldn't do that, but they might bring something else up for you, you know, a newspaper off of the lady or something like that. So anyway, this was quite a place in those days. Of course, the snow was a major concern to them as they were trying to get this camp done in a year when they have such a short operating season. And this was the method that they kept the road open in the winter, which is not any different than we do now. Matter of fact, that snowblower is probably the same one. Yeah. The grader looks like the same one. And of course, the town site of Winston was constructed, and Winston, it got its name from the contractor that built the village and built the docks, but the Winston Construction Company, and that's how it got its name. But there were up to, I think, about 90 homes in this area, which is just further up the road. If you haven't walked up there yet, you can still see the remnants of the streets and some of the stone walls and that. The buildings are all gone now. But this was all on National Forest, and the lots were 50 feet by 100 feet in size, and each person had to build their own house, and they paid the Forest Service $20 a year for the privilege of having their house.
Oh, my goodness. That sounds reasonable.
Not a bad deal.
I think that today.
Okay, we're going to have to really jump into high gear here. Anyway, they received permission finally for that power line permit in July of 1937. And the power line was constructed in January of 1938, all the way from Chelan. 700 poles were used. The power line came up the north side of Lake Chelan, crossed over to this side at Prince Street. Pardon?
How did it cross?
It just spanned over.
It was 4,100 and some odd feet long, and it was 130 feet above the lake.
Wow.
65.
Mm. Now, did they take it down?
They took it down. They set, you know, they
but it was the late 60s or early 70s, so I remember seeing that.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Anyway, they had to, you know, they had to really reinforce that cable with that long span. So
wow.
It was a
quite engineering thing. Went down.
In addition to that, each wire had a big red ball so that planes flying around would see it and not get tangled in the wires.
I don't know when we had our first float plane, but I mean, that was certainly been a hazard. So anyway, soon after the electricity started flowing, the mill was ready to receive ore. And on March 22nd, 1938, the first ton of ore was milled. So they were only a couple months off of their goal of having ore shipped in 1 year. Now that's still quite a feat when you consider what all they did in that period of time. The first shipment of concentrate reached Lucerne on April 7th, 1938, and then shipped them down in trucks to Lucerne, and then they had to be loaded on a barge. So it wasn't until April 9th that the first concentrate actually arrived in Chelan. And from there, it was offloaded from the barges onto trucks and then shipped a short distance to the rail yard there at Chelan, put on rail and shipped to the Tacoma smelter. Over $4 million was spent during the 42 years that it took to bring the mine into discovery. And the first load was shipped down lake. The first concentrates were fairly high grade. They were 2% copper, a little over, well, almost a percent and a half zinc, and an ounce of gold. The deposit overall averaged 1% copper, but that in the early years, they were kind of probably high grading it.
Within the first month of production, they were up at 1,400 tons and up to 2,000 tons by the end of the first year. See, dinner's at 6:15, isn't it? Okay. I got a little late start because someone else was in the room, so I run right close up to that time. Anyway, this is a diagram of the mine. This kind of shows you their mining plan. And this is the 1,500 level. This is the ore body right here, from here to here. Okay. And the idea was, these are these upper levels that we talked about. They went in from the surface and into the ore body, like this, and then the ore body crops out at the surface. They would mine out these large rooms underground, the entire width of the deposit, and hundreds of feet in length and hundreds of feet in height. And these rooms are called stopes. And they use kind of an interesting mining method to mine this, called long hole drilling. And they would, you may not be able to see it on the picture, but here's some outlines of these huge stopes. What they would do is they would drift across the ore body here. They would drill long holes down into the ore body. Then they would fill those holes up with explosives and just have one huge explosion. And all the ore would go down into draw points or ore chutes that would then be loaded into ore cars. And they would use gravity to help break up the rocks as they fell down these huge stopes. But that's how they mine the entire deposit. But the upper deposit, all the ore was moved by gravity. Even though they had a shaft that connected the upper levels, the shaft didn't haul ore, just men and equipment. And they used these stopes to get the ore down for draw points. Below the 1500 level, which is now all flooded, they had several crushers down there at depth. Actually, big large rooms where they had crushers set up underground. And there they had to haul the ore up, and then everything went out of the 1500 level into the mill.
There
were shafts, and they're like a big elevator. The shaft, they had two shafts in the mine. One went from the 1500 level up, and that was they just used that for equipment. Oh, okay. And
this main one.
Yeah.
Mavericks,
yeah. Okay, well, here's a couple, several pictures of what the main portal looked like when the mine was operating. It was an electric mine. All the trains ran on electricity. Overhead, overhead lines. You can see right here. Here's where they connects up, just like a trolley car, to the line. And these here would probably be cars they held to carry their workmen in, miners in. And if you get a chance to walk up there and take a look at what the portal looks like today. Here's the view as you would enter the mine. This is their main air door as you enter the 1500 level. These doors would shut so they can control the air of the mine. And here's one of the electric engines inside the mine. Again, you can see the trolley car type arrangement. These pipes over here, one would be air, the other one would be probably water, compressed air for running their equipment, their drills and stuff like that. And water, they need water to cool down the drill bits. Here is the number two hoist room. This is the number two shaft. This right here happens to be a cage for their workers. They would have another cage below it that would be where they would haul up their ore. This is the hoist room for this shaft, and you can see the cables coming up through the... This is a large room underground, about the size of a football field. I've got pictures I'll show later in the week, if you're still here to see some of the other lessons, of what it looks like today. Yeah, underground in these areas. But anyway, this is what ran the hoist there. Here's some pictures of the miners drilling their long holes that they would eventually fill with powder. Again, these are compressed air rotary drills that pretty high speed drills that can drill a long hole in a short period of time. And these are just braces to keep the drill in place. And they would drill kind of a fan pattern of holes out from one spot. They would just drill a series of holes in a fan. And then they move down a few feet and do the same thing. Then they just load those with hundreds of pounds of explosives. Here they are, ores coming out of one of these chutes and being loaded into the ore cars. And here they're dumping ore cars probably from one point in the mine to another. And I've got some pictures taken of this particular location that you'll see later in the week. Another view inside the 1500 level, way at the back. 1500 level, as I mentioned, you had to go through about 90 feet of glacial till, then you were in bedrock. Well, the ore body, the way the ore body dips, it's dipping steeply, but it's dipping steeply to the south. So, and it's way up on the hillside. So at the 1500 level, they had to go back in 1800 feet before they ever got to the ore zone. So they went through all that rock before they got to the ore zone. Here's a picture of miners underground. You're so far underground, you don't come out for lunch. You eat right where you work or in a little room underground. And notice the date here. This date is just about 1 month before the mine shut down. Here's a miner loading his truck. You might hear the term muck used, and that's a mining term for the broken ore that's laying. They call them muckers. They have a mucking machine, and it's a machine that would lift the ore into the ore car. Here, this guy is mucking, but he's hand mucking with a shovel, which is a lot harder. These guys right here are sitting in one of these big draw points and above a winze where the ore would drop down several hundred feet to the 1500 level. And periodically they'd get huge boulders that would, when they have these big explosions go off, these huge boulders would clog up these draw points, and they'd have to go in there with these sticks with dynamite on them, and they'd put them up in this draw point next to these big boulders, and then the run like heck. Here's a view of one of the stokes. There's right there is a guy standing across the stoke. This is looking into the stoke, and then as you look into it, this is what you see. This is about 75 to 100 feet in width. This is essentially the ore body. You can kind of see the outline of how it's dipping. And this is where they just essentially remove the entire ore body in these large rooms or stokes.
Is the Nahui filled with water?
Below the 1500 level. Above, they're wide open. And you can, later in the week, you can see some pictures of what these look like today.
Was there ever any major accident?
There were some fatalities, a very few. This was really a safe mine. And I got just about six, so I'm going to have to go through these. And if you have to leave, I won't feel bad. But the next several pictures basically take you through the milling operation. This is the ore would come in through this chute and drop down into the primary crusher, which was a jaw crusher, just like a jaw. It would go like this and crush the large rocks into smaller rocks. And then the smaller rocks would go through these cone crushers and make them even smaller yet. And then they'd go into these ball mills here, and they rotate, and they put big metal balls like this in there. They load them up and they've all determined the amount of steel balls you need. And then they just roll and grind until you get a real powder or silt size particles. In other words, you take it, you've gone from huge boulders down to silt size material. And they have to get it fine enough to liberate the sulfide minerals that have the ore in it. And you can see examples of all this up in the museum if you get a chance to go up there. They then add water to this fine mix, and they add two different organic compounds to it to help in the flotation process and recover the metals. In this mine, they use Santa Fe and pine oil. And they would add this to the, depending on, they would produce a copper concentrate and a zinc concentrate. And the metal particles would adhere to the oil or the organic matter. They would then pump air, compressed air, through these tanks and these flotation cells right here. And because these particles are oily, they adhere to the oil, or excuse me, adhere to the air and would float to the surface in this froth. And then these paddles would scrape it off into this water right here, and then it would be carried off into these huge tanks here, where they would dewater it and then load it into the buckets that were on the trucks that they hauled the concentrate down to the CERN. This is an early day picture of the tailings piles. This is how they constructed them. You notice they just left the trees there, build them up, and here this is these wooden pipes you'll see around here in places with wire around them, and this is how they got the tailings from the mill out to the tailings pile. The water, they would eventually dewater these tailings piles. The mine closed on June 28, 1957, because of a number of financial reasons. The price of copper went down substantially. Cost of labor was going up. The cost of lifting the ore from the lower parts of the mine was increasing. There's just a number of, plus the mill had been running for 20 years and needed a lot of replacement of parts, and everything came to a screeching halt because it just wasn't economical anymore to continue mining. 10 million tons of ore was mined during this period of time. 1.5 million tons of tailings were put back into the mine. The rest are on the surface out here. 408,000 tons of concentrate were shipped. 27,200 truckloads of concentrate. That's 27,000 truckloads. Now, up and down that hill without any accidents. Amazing. They held 5-ton buckets. The gross value at the time the mine was in operation was $66 million. Today, that, if you look at the metal prices today, that would have been $330 million today.
Mm-hmm. What did it cost to build the mine?
Well, they put $4 million into it before they started mining. That was just what they had spent.
I thought you said there was, you gave a figure. It was like $42 million.
I never gave a figure. They spent $4 million over 42 years getting it into production. But then, in addition to this price, there was also a cost for every ton of ore. You know, it cost them so much per ton of ore to get it mined and milled, and I don't know what that was. This is their gross value. And this is the what we're left with right now. And that's all I have. Until the bell rings, I guess I can answer a few questions.
It's wonderful.